All right, ladies and gentlemen, can we give a round of applause to our 14th panel of the event? Fantastic. Fantastic. Great. So we're going to get started. Medical practice profits, how investors, tech tools, and platforms are evolving within the multi-location medical practice platform space. So we're just going to go right down the line right here.
We invest in real estate and technology, mainly in health tech. That's kind of what we've been doing past 2 years.
Fantastic. Thank you. Moving down the line.
I'm a dentist. I started my dental group in 2014 and grew it. And in less than 5 years, we exited. We did a eight-figure sale. Ever since then, I kind of do what I like to do. I still practice 2 days a week. I do perform dental coaching for businesses and dentists that are having trouble with their business or want to improve it. So I feel like practicing 2 days a week still gives me that, you know, validity there. And I'm growing my family office now, so having a good time, and I'm really grateful to be here.
Fantastic. Thank you. And Richard, if you can introduce yourself and a little bit about why you're on this panel with us right now.
Sure. Yes. We have a division called Medical Clinic Capital. We have equity stakes that are minority. You know, we have some that are 20 and 50%, but we have 28 practices to about $60 million a year in revenue. We don't run them. We find high-power CEOs that haven't hit their ceiling of complexity and just help capitalize them and grow them. So that's why we're here, just kind of source deals and brought some of our friends on stage here.
Thank you.
My background's in the growth and development of healthcare platforms nationally. I've helped four different private equity firms do it. A couple years ago, me and two doctors started up Healthy U Clinics, where we leverage technology. I tell people we're a healthcare technology company with brick-and-mortar clinics. Yesterday was actually a two-year anniversary of our first clinic we opened, and we're in Arizona, California, and growing.
Excellent. Thank you. Next.
I'm also an avid investor and have actually built some software for the pharmacy space that is starting to take off a lot in Canada right now. We're looking to bring it to the U.S.
Fantastic. Excellent. And can I get just a show of hands? Please don't be shy if you are currently raising capital or working within the healthcare space. Healthcare, medical, pharmaceuticals, nice and high. Fantastic. Excellent. Because my next question is going to be for your firms, investment firms, the deals that you're currently sourcing, what type of deals are you currently sourcing? What kind of service providers are you guys currently on the lookout for going into 2024? Let's let Richard lead off with this question.
Yeah, sure. Lots of times we say we're investing in medical practices and everyone's brain goes straight to medical real estate. It's not what we do. We don't do FDA medical devices. We don't do pharma. We don't do biotech. We don't do the real estate underneath. It's just multi-location, profitable, the operating businesses of medical practices. If someone has one location and they're very profitable or it's a unique situation, we'll look at that. But usually it's 2 to 5, 10 locations and then we help them scale up and sell to private equity. That's what we get most excited about. Usually when you have multiple locations, multiple doctors per location, thousands of patients, the founder or two founders, something bad could happen to them health-wise, and you had reduced to the one or two cash cow locations, and the investors would still be fine. And we like that assurity and sleep at night confidence, and then they can sell for a huge multiple if they grow to what Trace has achieved and growing to 30, 40 plus locations or even just 15 plus. It's really the realm where private equity starts getting excited.
Awesome. Trace?
Yeah, I kind of back what Richard said. You know, I believe in the multi-state, multi-site platform and then growing that platform out. We also look at acquisitions and we start up new clinics and then we streamline and leverage technology to drive revenue within our clinics and offering healthcare to our patients, again, driving revenue. So technology is a huge part of the healthcare space today for those that are adopting that to grow their practices.
And can you elaborate a little bit more on what you mean by technology?
So payers or insurance companies will pay us more when we take better care of you, our patients, if we do our annual wellness visits and colonoscopies and these certain parameters. Most doctors have their heads down, nothing against them, just churning out patients. But we have software we're utilizing that shows us where we are in taking care and hitting those quality metrics that insurance companies reimburse us or pay us more than just doing our normal things. So it's better care for the patients, it saves the insurance companies money, and it makes us more money or drives higher revenue.
Yeah, I end up investing in and getting pulled in by a lot of family offices who are doing roll-ups, and they bring me in to do similar to what Trace is saying. I come in and say, okay, what could we do here to build a platform for you that's going to run your business, and how are we going to build that for you so that's scalable and that's going to drive value-added metrics, just like Trace was talking about. And so I love doing deals like that. And then actually when I go in the weeds with my partners, you know, we end up creating software. We got a pharmaceutical delivery service happening right now called Script Runner that started off just because it's a highly regulated industry and pharmacies are literally hiring somebody off the road and saying, please get the Schedule A narcotic to my grandmother. And that person's giving the wrong drug to the wrong person every day and people are dying. And nobody's paying attention to this. And so I was like, hey, we could solve this. And we built this from the pharmacy out. And it's just started, company has no employees, it's software running it. They're all contract employees with no incidents, and it's about to do 100K MRR. And, you know, we're starting to like put more fuel on that fire now. So that's something we built internally for their operation. And now they're going to have a spin out that's probably going to be worth more than the actual practices they own.
Fantastic. And how about what you're hoping to see, you know?
Oh, what am I hoping? I'm hoping to see more and more opportunities like that. I want to go and take antiquated, heavily regulatory areas that are still done by pen and paper and show how the digitization of it could actually bring insights and value.
Awesome. Chris? The question, once again, is, you know, what type of deals are you hoping to see? What are you guys looking at right now? What sub-niches within the healthcare industry do you feel like are important? Or even service providers that you guys are...
So we recently just did an exit on a health tech company at a Series A. When they raised a Series A, we were in very early. I'm not looking for just straight health tech. I'm actually looking for something different, something a company that wants to tackle the over 40 million people who are in rural areas. SDOH, social determinants of health. Someone like in Andreessen Horowitz's health team, they called it a payvider. Someone who is, you know, wanting to be a payvider. Just something different than just a standard norm. Someone wanting to push the envelope. That's what I'm looking for.
Got it. And I bet, I mean, there could probably be a lot of people here that tell you they're going to push the envelope. But what has you actually say, you know what, I'm actually going to take the time to review this deal, to sit down with you, you know, versus probably a lot of the deal flow that you're getting currently?
There's a lot of things that come across the desk that are just pure AI, and that doesn't exactly interest me, because me personally, I believe AI is more of a feature at this time than it is creating a whole business on it. So I usually pass on that kind of thing. I don't know. I'm just looking for someone or a company that's coming across the desk that wants to create a social impact when it comes to healthcare and actually change something, not just pile on and be a middleman or do the same thing that we've been doing, because that's perpetuating a broken system. Looking for something that's going to help change the system.
So like rural areas, because you talked about rural areas, like, I mean, you know, obviously a big topic has been that there's been like a huge opioid epidemic in these rural areas. So like something more like along those lines and like solving those types of issues, or?
Well, there's many people in within our own country who are over 30 miles from the nearest hospital. According to census, any population of 2,500 and less is considered rural. So you have over 40 million people that live in this country in a rural area that may only have access to one family doctor or not at all, and they're traveling very far. And then there's a lot of people who don't want to go outside their community and travel to the doctor because they believe you go to a hospital to die. So, you know, where are the companies that are wanting to tackle that? That's a large customer base that no one's touching. And that's also a lot of data that we're not gathering. I mean, that's that SDOH data that, you know, it's siloed. So how are we bringing this all together? That kind of thing. I'm just, I don't know, looking for something that's a spark, something different.
Yeah, awesome, awesome. Thank you. Great. And Dr. Henry?
Sure. So our dental group is always on the lookout for, you know, high quality dental practices with a founder that's got really great entrepreneurial spirit and growth minded. Our group's always looking for deals in the southeast part of the United States. That's where it started. On the coaching side, you know, I'm always staying on top of technology, the latest and greatest. This way I can provide for, you know, our clients the latest and greatest too, to make them as efficient as possible.
Awesome. Well, I got a couple of questions about that. I mean, you just talked about, like, okay, dental practice owners, very entrepreneurial, positive. I mean, I think that, you know, most entrepreneurs that have successful dental practices, they probably have generally a good attitude, but, you know, give me an example of, like, not the person you want to talk to, or, like, you know what, just give me a story. Like, who have you encountered that you're like, this person has a successful dental practice, but I had no interest in really pursuing business?
Well, there's usually some bullet points that we're looking out for. We always want to have a practice that has multiple doctors, not just one doctor. So right, that, like, all these bullet points will knock off a lot. I mean, we're looking for a certain amount of revenue. We're not looking for any Medicaid type practices. So just really high quality. And I think the best way to describe it is a personality type, you know, has to be open. Because a lot of times, you know, a doctor can grow to a certain point, but they hit that point, it gets hard to keep going. So, like, the services that we provide are economies of scale. You know, what are they having trouble with? And we always have centralized services. So somebody's got to be open is the easiest way I can describe it to you, to, you know, new things.
Yeah. So one thing I'd add to that is that lots of times we see somebody can run one medical practice themselves, hire another doctor, maybe two more doctors. They open another medical practice, might be working a couple days a week at two practices. Sometimes they can stretch themselves to three. But there's no way to run around town and run more than three medical practices without hiring very strong leadership underneath. So one thing we look for is someone who's really built the infrastructure to have the five or seven practices. Or like when I first met Trace, and I've invested in HealthyU, and one of our members has put in about $1 million as well. You know, he already was at eight practices, and there's no way to stretch yourself to eight. Like, if you got to eight, then you have some systems in place, if the wheels aren't falling off, to scale a lot faster and further. So that's something we kind of look for as well, is like, how are they managing what they're doing? And just kind of looking at how they're handling that level of complexity.
Fantastic. And in a minute, I'm going to open up questions to our audience. So if you guys want to start thinking about questions you want to ask our panelists, especially any of our healthcare experts out here, please just know that in a couple minutes, I'll be opening up the floor to that. But let's talk a little bit about deal structures, right? Chantal, you were talking about the pharmaceutical delivery company. You know, can you share a little bit about how that negotiation went down, how much of a strategic partner you guys maybe became to, you know, do you seek to be a strategic partner?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so a part of our venture studio is that, hey, we go and partner with gentlemen up here. And so I come to this panel with a little bit different of a take where, you know, they've done their due diligence and they know what the issues are in the business. And I come from a technology background to help solve it. So deal structure, it really depends. You know, we, in this pharmaceutical business that we did, we put capital in. They didn't put capital in. We came in with our capital, with our people, and then we started building it out. And it really ended up being a 60-40 split that they had. Only because I had the vindiction that, hey, we could go and get this done. I've done other deals also where, you know, it's been the other way around. And so it really depends on who's bringing what to the table for me when I'm looking to build out a platform. There's also been just fee for service. And, you know, those are not the ones that interest me the most that I do.
Excellent. Anybody else want to go there? I'll ask Chris. Chris, I know you were talking about a Series A round as well, but can you tell a little bit, speak more to the structures that you guys are kind of looking or negotiating in terms of terms?
It's hard to say because it varies. We're very early in, so C state, so It really varies depending on the firm, and also depending on if we're doing more hands-on approach as a more of a passive approach.
Is that more common to do a hands-on approach, or?
So for us, since we're a smaller family office, or considered smaller, we like to be a little more hands-on because, you know, to make sure that we're still viable, we have to basically hit 2 or 3 out of 10. As a larger fund, maybe only has hit 1 out of 20. So we tend to be a little hands-on, but not always.
Got it. And Henry, can you speak to that? Are you guys more hands-on? Do you guys really get in there, or is it more just?
I feel like we provide service in our group, you know. So everybody's got their own issues. Everybody's unique, you know. So having lots of levers to pull and lots of economies of scale can, you know, are you having trouble with your incoming calls? Are you having trouble with, you know, your providers doing this? So having that group that has all those services there is really beneficial, like to the dentists that, you know, come into the group, because they're saying, hey, I'm stressed out, I'm nervous, you know, I have to do everything. Because, you know, truth be told, most dentists are not good business owners. Mm-hmm. They were trained in the skill of dentistry, but they were never taught anything about business. Everything that I ever learned about business was coming to masterminds, you know, things like this. So most dentists don't even have that background. So to give them that, you know, kind of like we got your back kind of mentality is really beneficial to them.
Do you ever encounter a situation where it's like people want help, but then once you're really going in there and, you know, maybe they're not ready to step into that level of like vulnerability to really talk out the issues?
For sure. Yeah, it happens a lot. And I mean, fortunately, you know, haven't seen that much, because I think there's a lot of, like has been mentioned in this conference hundreds of times, is due diligence and going behind the scenes and seeing if they have a good team already in place. Because if they don't have a good team in place, it's going to be hard to go, you know, that much forward with them.
What determines a good team?
Most of the time we're looking for, everybody in our group has used EOS, Entrepreneurial Operating System, before. Because once you get to a certain point, you know, you need to have the team-focused practice. And so I think that anybody that's implemented that system is usually like, boom, that check off that bullet point big time.
Excellent. I know we have a question, but I do want to, the question about deal structures, I want to hand it off to Richard as well. If you can elaborate on interesting structures.
We use a lot of gross revenue royalty structures. We also use like rights of participation and buyback rights, or we'll have something where we basically become a partner in the medical practice group, but on a moving forward basis. So we don't get a free lunch. They keep what they've built up the last so many years, but then we're going to make the pie 3-5 times bigger. And so we'll participate on a go forward basis to help really scale them up. And the other creative structure is that we own more medical industry domain names than anyone else that are single word domain names. So we own dermatologist.com, obstetricians.com, geriatricians.com, parasitologist.com, facials.com, a whole bunch of other ones you'll be bored to listen to. But I bring it up because we're structuring that because we're going to be finding medical practices to capitalize, but also invest in lieu of cash, the industry leading Fifth Avenue piece of digital real estate for a national dermatology platform, the domain name, and help bring in more patients. They can put that on billboards or advertising on social media, et cetera. So it's something kind of unique and fun that we're working on in the space as well.
Awesome, awesome. And I think we have a question. We have a question?
Hello, is this one?
If you can stand up for us.
I'm gonna block the light over here.
Your name, where you're from, right there is fine.
Just my bald head will block everything. I have a few portfolio companies, one of which is in the marketing space. We service a lot of healthcare tech type of clients. And I was just curious, when you guys are doing due diligence on some of these acquisitions, one thing that I've come across just in the marketing space is you'll see the Google local listings a lot. And they can't reply to them because there's HIPAA violations if they actually acknowledge that a patient was seen. So how the, just kind of curious on when you guys are vetting these deal flows and what kind of risk and liability does it go into that far? Are you looking at, you know, things that they've been doing? Some of them will have a QR code, you know, asking people reviews, and that's, you know, practice that may or may not be, you know, valid. Just curious how deep you guys go in the due diligence process there. And then what, as far as the tech tools and platforms, you know, do you guys go into the operating side and, you know, help offer solutions to mitigate some of those like HIPAA compliant web hosting? Because all of them have forms taking bookings, and that's actually a violation of HIPAA. Just curious on that.
And we're getting a little echo, so I'm just going to reiterate the question that he said. But when your due diligence practice, you know, are you guys looking at making sure to mitigate risk and look into these practices, making sure they're following HIPAA laws? Like, what are you guys doing to make sure, you know, because he's stating like, you know, some practices may ask for Google reviews and that's not, you know, that's against regulation potentially. So what are you guys doing to really risk mitigate in your due diligence process?
I'm happy to kind of speak on that a little bit. We do a lot of acquisitions. And we do look at the doctors, their licenses, has anything been, you know, do they have anything against their licenses? I mean, to help us mitigate risk. And then we also, we do background checks on every provider even the owners, if their medical practice, I mean, if their doctors providing, so that we can help mitigate risk, because we have found where they have things against their license that they didn't disclose during the due diligence process that make us have red flags. And so we do honestly try to scope everything out, because once you buy them and you own that practice, if Medicare or the state or whatever comes after that practice that happened previous, you own it now.
But is there anything that you do, because, you know, maybe there haven't been red flags yet, you know, or they could be potentially be doing things that they shouldn't be doing, but they just, in essence, have not been caught yet. What are you guys doing to maybe catch those things before HIPAA does for it?
Well, and we also look at how they're coding and billing for insurance companies. I mean, to your point, so we do the deep dives, because we don't want to end up with a headache. I mean, that's probably the best way to mitigate it. And so, again, the background checks, and then we do a deep dive into their billing practices just to make sure, because it is illegal to overcode, is what they call it. So if they put down that they've done more than they really did, especially, you know, people lose their licenses over it, and it's, we don't want to be in that position.
It, we often take 3 to 9 months, sometimes 18 months, to develop a relationship, look at the financials, meet them in person, go see the practices. They get to know and trust us. We had a doctor here this week that has 8 practices doing $10 million a year in revenue. He wants to grow to 100 practices, so he's getting to know us, and vice versa. So our goal is to look at everything possible under due diligence, to the extent that, you know, you can sleep at night, that if something went wrong, there's nothing you could have done on due diligence to prevent that. And you have exhausted every beyond reasonable doubt way of looking at the deal, and then try to move forward from there.
Do you think, and asking you, Richard, is there anything in the due diligence process that you think that you do that most people don't, like something that they should do?
Asking the questions up front over email, most people don't do that. They get on a phone and spend 30 minutes of their time, and they could just send over 7 questions and eliminate 80% of the stuff coming towards them. Going out for drinks with someone and I don't drink the alcohol. I'll get a glass of warm milk or something less exciting, but you know, what they say over alcohol might be completely different than what they say in a business meeting. So stuff like that, just get to see who they are as human beings. And if they're not like a really great person, then just move on, 'cause there's a lot of people in the industry to work with.
Just to add on to some of the things that they said, I mean, just personality. We love to go out with somebody They like see how they treat waitresses, see how they treat, you know, people. Do they hold the door open, you know, for a lady when they walk in? And just little things like that are really important that we always look at just to see the character of the person. The other thing is, I feel like the landscape has changed. It used to be, you know, you're going to buy a dentist's office, you're going to, you know, somebody's going to sell their practice. It used to be like, oh, somebody 50, 60 or something like that. The bar has changed. I know our group is now looking at like 30s, 40s. Why? Because they've grown so much, like Richard said, and maybe they need help and they want to maybe take some risk off the table, because that 55, 60-year-old dentist, he's not going to want to grow anymore. He's going to want to leave day one, right? And that's it. We want to have somebody that's a partner that will grow together. So I think that's an interesting thing that has changed in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years.
Awesome. Awesome. Chris?
I don't have any experience in taking over practices or things like that. I did attempt one investment from a guy in, he had a practice in New York City, Brooklyn area, and at doing some due diligence, background check, found out he was under investigation for Medicaid fraud. So, of course, I backed away, but that's my only experience when it comes to that. I've been in the health tech investments.
Tom?
Yeah, I work with a large PE firm based out of Toronto, where we come in and for any kind of acquisitions they're doing, we go and check all their technology audits. I know he was talking about storing information in the cloud and making sure that the audit trail is compliant. So we actually on staff have 2 people who are just regulatory compliance experts in healthcare from a technology standpoint.
You guys ever hire third-party due diligence firms to help? Like, is that something?
I mean, I end up becoming that for that private equity firm, right? So I become the service provider to do at least that piece of the due diligence.
Yeah, we've used we've used Checker for background checks, but then we've used VCheck for a little bit more of an investigative background check. But we're speaking with one of our family office club members. All their team does is due diligence for investment companies. They don't raise capital, they don't have their own deals, et cetera. So we're talking to them and trying to figure out like what they're doing. So we see that as a big need of many private investors in our club. is like, who could they rely upon to really outsource some of that due diligence and go really deep for them? So.
Excellent. Do we have another question from the audience? Yes, we do right here.
Thanks for the information, guys. I really appreciate it. Two-part question. In the dental space, what do you see as far as aggressive EBITDAs right now as far as for purchase? And then the second thing is, in the dental space or medical space, what's the biggest problem that they're facing, especially sole practitioner or one or two doctors? I think Dr. Ernst, you had mentioned administrative. So if I were to say, in general, hey, I'll buy your practice, 3.5 EBITDA. I'm going to keep you on. Please stay on for 3 years. I'll pay you salary. And I'll plug and play an administrative, a uniform administrative system that we use with other companies. So basically you're 9 to 5, 9 to 7, whatever it is. Does that handle that problem, or do you see other problems? Thank you.
Real quick, one challenge is that it might be practical to buy a business at 3.5 times EBITDA, but Henry will probably tell you most people are wanting 5, 6, 7 times EBITDA. And the problem is that these big PE groups, some good, some not, will come and they'll say, yeah, we'll give you 7.5x EBITDA. But you read the 120 pages of fine print, some is paid over time, some only if you hit hurdles, some of it is in shares and equity in the mothership company that may or may not get recapped ever, or may not go public one day. So the 7.5x is really not the same as selling for a 4x. I know that Trace has gotten some amazing deals done where somebody doesn't want a 5-year earnout or 3-year earnout or 120 page document. They want to trust another peer type group, not have all the back end headache. And that problem is Trace's opportunity and how they're blowing up to 40 practices. But I think both of these individuals could probably comment on some parts of your question there.
And I can comment, like in the medical space, interest rates are high. So private equity firms and VC firms, they're offering less today because money's more expensive. But there's been a shift in the marketplace the last couple of years with healthcare conglomerates. Yes, they're looking at EBITDA or total revenue, but they're also paying per patient. And so we've seen a huge shift, and the healthcare conglomerates are paying more than, my whole background's been in private equity, and they're paying more than private equity has ever paid that I've seen or been involved with. And so we are gearing up for an exit next year, and we will definitely be only, or technically only going to healthcare conglomerates that are paying for patient lives and the structure and these things that we're talking about, outside of EBITDA, which is traditional PE and VC backed.
And I would say that as investors coming in, investors look at dentistry like, wow, you know, 2020 and COVID was like the worst thing that could ever happen to dentistry. You can't social distance when you're working on somebody and there's aerosols everywhere. So looking at it from a business perspective, you know, dentistry came through COVID, and wow, what other thing can you come through? And it came through like really well. The problem nowadays is profitability. Everything costs so much more. You know, people, our equipment, everything's more expensive. But to another part of your question there, that's one part I mentioned before, is we're always looking for the doctors who want to stay, and we have a good feeling they're going to stay, because a lot of the deals nowadays are structured where maybe the doctor gets 2/3 up front, cash. So if we have that 60-year-old, then I've seen this before. Day one of the deal being completed, the doctor's gone. And the doctor, you know, doesn't, he got his 65%, and the rest, he doesn't care about leaving the rest on the table. So that's a really important part, is to make sure you're partnering with somebody who wants to stay, and there's obviously skin in the game. So that, this example that I'm mentioning, like the economies of scale had to come in, and looking back, it was a good thing because we got newer doctors in there, and now that practice has even turned around a lot more. But you have to really keep the eyes out for the person, the structure of the deals, and what are they looking for. The more that they're going to want cash up front, obviously, is going to be that red flag that they're wanting to walk right away that first day.
Fantastic. Great. Do we have another question in the audience? Fantastic.
One question here. What are some problems in the prescription delivery space that pharmacies face on a day-to-day, either from a risk or a cost standpoint, that you're starting to solve? And this is for you, Sheetal.
In the pharmaceutical delivery space, there's a bunch. You know, A is cost. It gets pretty expensive. But I think the biggest thing is like harm to patients, being sending the wrong drugs to the wrong person, or even just the audit trail of like a Schedule A narcotic being delivered to someone, and it, you know, and not being able to know where it is at that time. Like, if you we get calls, the pharmacies get calls all the time of like, hey, I never got my medicine. It's like, well, wait a second. Joe, your son actually signed for it and we got his ID in the software and everything like that. If before our software got implemented, that was a nightmare. It would take 2 days to figure that out. If a drug wasn't delivered and it had to come back to the pharmacies, it was a whole other nightmare. And so we now have an audit trail of every step of the way where the drug is. The actual driver doesn't even know where stop B is. We've actually done routing where it's like package one goes to this address. You don't even see the second address for package B before that gets done. And so it's all it's all encompassed in one software solution. And then payments was also an issue because so many people still do cash on delivery. And so we, you know, I got a tech background and I've got a couple of fintech companies too. And so we implemented a payment solution where, hey, we can now take payment right out the door and whether it be cash or card. And so we've taken all the headaches out of that pharmaceutical delivery aspect. And that Script Runner is one of those companies that we've been able to do that with. But those are the types of things that you could really, as you guys all, you know, could bring economies of scale and actually bump up your EBITDA numbers if you start doing it right.
I understand. One quick comment. Jock Solotov was sick, so he couldn't be here with us today, but we did a fireside chat with him in San Francisco. He's had $2 billion plus exits in healthcare. He now has $25 billion in revenue in his current company. He's the largest equity holder in that LLC group. And he always emphasizes that building his board with the people that will determine his destiny is one of the biggest things. And people said, oh, well, how'd you get the billionaires to invest with you? And he said, well, I helped make them billionaires by doing deals earlier with them. And he would find like a big insurance company and then put them on the board or someone that was a big healthcare system that would open lots of doors for him. And then the company not only grows 100 times faster, but they also will defend the company if someone tries to harm it, or the insurance company themselves is on the cap table. They're not going to harm their own publicly traded company or their own entity. So that's some of the exciting stuff we're doing, like with Healthy You and like the next iteration of their evolution over time. And some people say, oh yeah, the healthcare stuff, yeah, that's nice. You know, we're an exciting venture capital or fintech, et cetera. But to create a $100 million platform in 2 years, you know, that's pretty exciting. I'd put that up against any tech company here in the room. So it's exciting to watch these guys grow their practices and their platforms.
Yep, very exciting. Well, I have one more question for our panelists. Really, it's going to be like a 20-second golden nugget going down the line. 2024, right? We talked about higher interest rates. We talked about how it costs more money for talent, for equipment, everything, right? So in 2024, those are a lot of the challenges that we can anticipate. What is a quick 20, 30 second soundbite that you can give our audience on what to do going forward? Piece of advice. Chris, we'll start with you.
Piece of advice.
Or your favorite quote that inspires you every morning.
I don't know, piece of advice. I think it's gonna get rough next year, so.
Good luck and hold on tight.
Yeah, I don't really know. I mean, it might be a great buying opportunity when it's rough. It's great buying opportunities. I don't know.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Henry.
I kind of look at it this way. Like, you know, when you look at your KPIs for every business, and I'm just talking about from the dentistry point of view, and there are certain things that we just can't control. And what you can't control is taking good care of people and moving the production numbers. The production numbers, if they're high, they always let all the other numbers just sort itself out. And then you mentioned favorite quote. I'm gonna go with Ric Flair. When I was younger, I used to love Ric Flair, you know, woo. And he always used to say, to be the man, you have to beat the man. What that means to me is always find the person who's the best at something, follow what they do, use them as a mentor, and try to get to their level.
I really love that. I really love, you know, 2024, what you can control is how you treat people. That's huge.
That's awesome. Didn't you get to see Rick in person? I think I saw on Facebook or something, right?
His last match. I was there.
Nice. Become more like him, I guess. Proximity, right? Great. So I guess mine would be David Goggins had a video I put out. He said that the great differentiator between people is when, you know, it's easy to do well when you're feeling good. You don't have a headache. The economy's good. Everything's going smooth. We all have days and months and years like that. But the great differentiator is how do you keep on moving forward and make lots of progress and be very consistent and be very disciplined about what you're doing when things are not easy, and when you don't feel good, when the company's not being ran well, and your market is in a tough time. I think that's what makes a big difference, because lots of people just quit, give up, get distracted. So that's one of my favorite quotes I try to remember.
And then my biggest goal is I want to double our entire platform, from our clinics to our technology stack. And I'm big into vision boards and goals, and I would tell all of you to have them. And just one of my top thing on the top of my vision goal or board, it just says everything goes my way. Like, I get up as if everything's going to go my way that day, and I work towards that. And so I'm just big in being driven, and kind of like Richard said, if it's a good day or a bad day, I get to have a good day, and I get to, you know, show that to our team members.
I'll give you a piece of advice. One of my friends who's had a couple billion-dollar exits, too, just gave me recently, and he goes, every Saturday, he actually opened up his journal, and every Saturday he writes down everything he did that week. Actually, I should start, every Sunday he writes down everything he wants to accomplish that week, and then every Saturday he writes down what he actually did. And that kept him honest all the way through and what to do. So the quote to that is, I guess, Marcus Aurelius, the obstacle is the way.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you. Well, before I let our panelists go, before I let you off to lunch, other than that, we can please give a huge round of applause to our healthcare panel.
Join the Family Office Club by visiting familyoffices.com. We look forward to seeing you at our next live event.